Back in 2007, Christopher Hitchens, a well-known British journalist and author, wrote the book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Notice how God is small. Hitchens was part of a movement that is today called the New Atheism. There was an explosion of vitriolic books against religion in the early to mid-2000s. The movement today is called the New Atheism, even if the arguments themselves are pretty much the same as the old atheism. The new is the difference in tone. The New Atheism goes on the attack against religion in a way that the old atheism never did. Hitchens became a proselytizer for atheism and a savage critic of religion. And he debated a wide spectrum of religious thinkers, Christian thinkers, Islamic thinkers, Jewish thinkers. He was a brilliant debater, even if at times he was a bit loose with the facts. He was a rhetorical master, a brilliant demagogue. He spoke powerfully to people's emotions. He had also the voice of Richard Burton to boot. So you can imagine he was a formidable debate opponent. And in my experience, having watched a lot of his debates with religious thinkers, he often came out on top in those debates, often got the best of his opponent. After writing his book, God is Not Great, back in 2007, he went on a book tour, and in that tour, he debated with various religious thinkers as a way of promoting his book and its ideas. In 2007, as part of this tour, he debated a quiet and rather unassuming professor from the University of Texas named Martin Olasky. Go to the next slide, there's a picture of Olasky. There he is. Olasky was a kind of introverted professor type, you know, quiet, unassuming. You could tell he didn't want to be at the debate. He'd done it as a favor to the debate organizers. This kind of debate was not his style. So he was there under a certain degree of duress. Yet he was perhaps the most formidable debate opponent that Hitchens ever faced. Olasky took quiet umbrage at Hitchens' extreme positions, especially the position that religion poisons everything. Everything? Really? Olasky, in his opening remarks, listed example after example of Christian people, because he's a Christian, examples of Christian people who had made self-sacrificing choices based on their faith. A Christian couple who adopted 7 difficult-to-place children. One child who had autism, another child who had cerebral palsy and ongoing physical health challenges, a further child who suffered severe burns from a hateful parent. This couple had heard the call to adopt difficult-to-place children from God, to adopt openly needy children into their family. How can you, Christopher Hitchens, claim that religion poisons everything when you have an example like this? Olasky offered further examples. A person gave up their high-paying job in the tech world to start up an orphanage in Zambia for AIDS children, children whose parents had died of AIDS. They did this because they heard a call from God to do it. That's why they did it. A man in South Washington, D.C. started a program for drug addiction, which has led hundreds and hundreds of people out of desperate circumstances. Why? Because he heard a call from Jesus to do it. Olasky presented story after story after story after story of men and women who had, at significant personal sacrifice, made a difference in the world around them because of their faith. They had been given a vision of one type or another. A vision had come to them from God, and they had acted on it to bless the world around them. They had conformed their lives to the vision that they had received from God. They were obedient to a heavenly vision. That allowed them to become an antidote to the poison of the world. Rather than religion poisoning everything, religion can at times be the antidote to the poison of the world. At least Olasky claimed this. Have you ever had a heavenly vision? What do you think? For some people, it's hard to say, isn't it? It doesn't have to necessarily be something large. That's why sometimes we don't recognize it for what it is. It doesn't have to be really large. It doesn't always have to be life-changing. It can be, of course, but it doesn't always have to be life-changing. It might be a small heavenly vision, a nudge to do something, a nudge to call someone, a nudge to move out from your circle of comfort, a nudge to pick up something for someone for no unknown reason to you. Maybe you get an inspiration for an idea that you don't know where that inspiration comes from. Maybe that's the heavenly vision that's come to you. What do you do with these moments? How do you respond to them? Do you recognize them as God-inspired? The Apostle Paul certainly had a heavenly vision. He had an immense heavenly vision. He had a radical, life-changing heavenly vision. There he was, a zealous Pharisee, persecuting the early church, making the life of those early Jesus followers as difficult as he could. He threw some of those Jesus followers into jail. He was at the trials that led to some of their execution. He voted in favor of their death. He is on fire to stamp out that Christian sect that's developing. He believes he's on a God-ordained journey, and he goes on a trip to Damascus with the authority of the Jewish High Council to uproot the early Christian movement in that city. It's on this journey that he is confronted by an overwhelming light, by a voice that's castigating him. "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Who are you, Lord?" he asks back. And here's something totally unexpected, something that should be impossible. The voice says, "It is I, Jesus." In that moment, understand that everything in Paul's life that he'd been working towards was overturned. One simple sentence overturned. Everything he had been working towards has now become absolutely pointless to the answer to one simple question: "Who are you, Lord?" "It is I, Jesus." Would you want this kind of heavenly vision to come to you? What do you think? A total life-changing moment that sends you in a completely different direction than the one you were originally going in. What do you think? Would you want this kind of vision to come to you? And if you got this kind of vision, would you make yourself obedient to it? Would you conform your life to it? Would you follow it? I think most of us are banking on the fact that we won't get this type of heavenly vision given to us. Not like Paul's. We're counting on it in our planning. Think about your future planning, all the planning you've done for your future. Does it include the possibility of a heavenly vision coming to you? Probably not. Even serious people of faith don't want this kind of heavenly vision given to them. Not of this magnitude. A little heavenly vision, yeah, that's pretty good. A medium-sized heavenly vision, I could probably deal with it. But the enchilada, the big enchilada, heavenly vision, no thanks. I think most of us would do our best to avoid this possibility. Here's the thing, right? We don't really know what God has in store for us. We don't know what God has in store for us. There's no way of predicting it. Not everybody gets the big enchilada vision the way Paul did. Not everybody gets that. You know, most people get medium and smaller visions. But who's to say what vision God has in store for you? There's just no way of knowing for sure. It's not that we consciously and deliberately go out of our way to disobey God. It's just that we don't listen to God by intention. Because if we don't hear what God is saying to us, well, then we can't be blamed if we don't obey the call. If we don't recognize what God is saying to us, asking of us, we can't be faulted for being unwilling to conform ourselves to the blessing and opportunity of the heavenly vision. Sorry, God, I just didn't hear you. And this is my strategy to avoid seeing or hearing the heavenly vision. If I can be just distracted enough, and if I can be just caught up enough in my own wants and desires in life, there's a good chance I won't hear the Lord knocking when he comes around. With a little bit of luck, I won't hear the call or see the vision. I think of that verse from the song, "With a Little Bit of Luck," you know, the song in My Fair Lady. The Lord above made man to help his neighbor, no matter where, on land or sea or foam. The Lord above made man to help his neighbor, but with a little bit of luck, with a little bit of luck, when he comes around, you won't be home. With a little bit, with a little bit, with a little bit of luck, you won't be home. With a little bit, with a little bit, with a little bit of luck, you won't be home. I just keep my head down enough, and with a little bit of luck, I won't be at home when the heavenly vision comes knocking. I won't be home for it. It was a powerful experience to hear Alasky's reciting stories of his, hear Alasky reciting stories of Christians who had received a heavenly vision and followed through with it. Story after story making a difference in the world. Story after story of people making a difference in the world because of a godly vision given to them. The power of obedience to a heavenly vision that makes God's will real in life. It was inspiring to hear. I was listening to Alasky's recitation, and I felt proud of my Christian faith. I felt proud of my Christian faith. It inspired me to want to go further in my spiritual walk with Jesus. And I think most of us enjoy hearing powerful testimonies from people of faith. It's great to listen to personal testimonies, listening to inspiring stories of faith, listening to inspiring human stories generally. It can be an uplifting experience to hear them. I'm glad somebody somewhere is getting into this faith thing, getting into the groove of faith. I'm glad somebody somewhere is making this Christian thing real. As I say, I'm open to hearing the stories of people's faith journey and the heavenly visions that come to them. Listening to a servant of God speak is one thing, but it's not quite the same thing as God speaking to us directly. Hearing about other people's heavenly vision, whether it's scripture like Paul or from Alasky's reciting of stories or from a person's own lips, that's one thing. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing, but it's not the same thing as God speaking to you and to me directly, giving us a heavenly vision directly firsthand. Hearing stories about people who were obedient to the heavenly vision is a good thing, a necessary thing. Being obedient to the heavenly vision given to us is better still. Now, I will admit to you that it's not always simple, a simple thing to recognize the heavenly vision when it comes. In Paul's case, it was pretty straightforward. A simple question, a simple answer. Who are you, Lord? It is I, Jesus. And there are lots of stories of people of faith who have had this kind of straightforward, simple vision given to them. It's not a completely unique situation. I think God's calling. Better answer it. Yet I suspect in a lot of stories that Alasky was referencing to, they were more complicated than they sounded. Like adopting children, difficult to place children, or setting up a program for drug addiction, or building and running an orphanage in Africa. I'm sure that these stories are really the fruit of a much longer process of discernment. It took people time to figure out that they had received a heavenly vision. Not just a momentary flickering of the heart, So perhaps the stories that Alasky told were oversimplified. They oversimplified a longer-term process, a more complex journey to recognition. Sometimes the heavenly vision becomes a thorn to us that we just can't get rid of. We don't initially even recognize the vision, and so it becomes a festering wound in our soul that needs satisfaction, that haunts us day in and day out. The heavenly vision becomes something that we got to work out in our lives over months, maybe years, decades even. It may require us to venture out without even complete certainty that we've received a heavenly vision. It will mean that we must at times move out initially by faith. Even Paul didn't understand the implications of what this heavenly vision was about. Three times in the book of Acts, he recounts his meeting of Jesus on the way to Damascus. In Acts 26, which we just heard earlier in the service, this is the third time he relates the story of his meeting of Jesus on the way to Damascus. Third time. This is 25 years after the event. This is after he's journeyed through the Eastern Mediterranean many times as a witness to Jesus. This is after he's visited hundreds and hundreds of communities along the way. This is after he's written many of his letters to the churches. He's recounting now to Agrippa reflects a mature and insightful understanding of the heavenly vision given to him. In Acts 9, where we first experience and see and meet the story of Paul's encounter with Jesus, there's no mention of a mission to the Gentiles. There's no sense of any plan being given to Paul in that moment. There's no immediate sense of purpose to Paul's experience. There's only the overwhelming sense of a life being turned upside down. It will take Paul years to figure out what this encounter with Jesus is all about. It'll take years. Take years to figure out what it means. So I suppose the ground zero of any heavenly vision given to us is the willingness to have our hearts disturbed. Perhaps the first step for most of us in receiving a heavenly vision is an open heart to the world around us. A heart willing to be moved by the suffering of the world. A heart willing to be reorientated for a different purpose in life. This is about opening our heart to a greater purpose than ourselves. How far are we willing to let this heartburst for the world go in us? Sadly, in many cases, not far enough. When Trillium worked with the church consultant Tom Bandy back, 12, 13 years ago, he asked us personally, and he asked us as a church this question: who does your heart burst for? Whose situation in this world causes your heart to burst? Whose circumstances in this life awakens a deep compassion in you for? Who do you yearn to bless? Is there anyone's circumstances that touches you deeply today? Anyone beyond your biological family that speaks to you? That touches you deeply again and again, that won't let go of you. I have no doubt that God has given each one of us here who have gathered in this place today and who have gathered online a heavenly vision. Probably more than one vision. Probably many visions. Do you remember hearing a vision from God? Do you remember seeing it before you? Do you know what it is? Do you still have it? Often we lose or forget the heavenly vision that God has given us. It gets buried in the busyness of our lives. It gets left behind as we move along in life. The vision may come to us as a little seed that gets displaced and then forgotten. Sometimes we lose the vision because of our own lack of spiritual growth, our own unwillingness to grow. We are not willing to conform our lives to the vision so that the heavenly vision of God that has been given to us is never fulfilled. Christopher Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, and books like it have made a real impact on our culture. It has made the challenge of the church and its witness harder today than probably it's been in a long, long time. People today really question the reality and the existence of God. in a more direct manner than ever before. People are more skeptical that there is a higher power today than ever. And people are certainly more hesitant towards the church and religious community generally today than ever before. The most powerful response to the skepticism of the world is the living faith of believers. The living faith of believers becomes real as people live out the heavenly vision given to them in their lives. That's why I think Martin Alaski was Christopher Hitchens' toughest debate opponent. Alaski was able to turn to the living proof, to rebut Hitchens' claims in his book. Alaski turned to the living witness of real people, everyday people of faith, making sacrifices, real self-sacrificing choices to bring about God's way of life on earth. He referred to people who had become broken bread and poured out wine because they had received a vision from God. Not only does religion not poison everything, but religion, good religion, can be the antidote to the poison of the world. And it is faithful believers that give proof that God, the God of love, is great. Some of Alaski's examples came from one little church in Maryland, just one little church of 50 people. Many of the stories came from that church, a church that took its faith and witness seriously, where many people were committed to being obedient to the heavenly vision given to them, to giving evidence to the reality of God in their lives, and committing themselves powerfully, powerfully to the way of holy love. If Alaski had been debating Hitchens up here in Ontario, could he have used us as part of his example? Would there have been enough evidence of a godly way at Trillium? A people living out a heavenly vision at Trillium, could he have used us as a part of his rebuttal to Hitchens' claims? When Alaski was done, Christopher Hitchens was speechless. This is the only time in all the debates that I saw him in that he was speechless. In many of the debates and interviews that I watched of him, he was the master of repartee and debate. But today he was flummoxed, confounded by Alaski's comments. We cannot bring the heavenly vision to fulfillment through our own efforts. The vision itself belongs to God, but we must live under its inspiration until it fulfills itself through us. That's what Paul did. He lived obedient to the heavenly vision, and the world was changed by it through him. Many of us today have been given a heavenly vision. It may be in our back pocket. It may be in the drawer downstairs in the cabinet. Don't you think it's time that we dusted it off, pulled it out, and took up its challenge? Maybe some of us are waiting to receive a new heavenly vision. How about we open our hearts and commit ourselves to receiving the heavenly vision from God and then making ourselves obedient to it? How about we conform our lives to the vision so that God's will of love in heaven may be done here on earth through us? Our witness at Trillium is completely and totally dependent on you and me living under the inspiration of God's vision. Being obedient to the heavenly vision, conforming our lives to the heavenly vision, and who knows what can be accomplished when we live this way together. Paul's vision changed the world. Maybe the vision given to you or me can too.